This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about prison law. I am joined by prison law advocate and freelance legal advisor Carla Riozzi. Carla conducts trials in the Magistrates Court and at the Crown Court, and she attends to clients at the police station. Carla specialises in prisoners' rights, and she has been employed by the British Embassy in Bangkok, assisting British nationals detained across Thailand. Carla has won an award for her work and dedication for prisoners' rights. Carla, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Hattie. It's nice to be invited onto your show.
It's lovely to have you. It really is. Prison law. Okay, so there are currently 117 prisons in England and Wales. As of March 2021, the gov.uk's website monthly bulletin stated that there are over 78,000 prisoners in England and Wales. Let's talk about prison law. Let's explain to our listeners, Carla, what do we actually mean by prison law?
Yes, thank you, Hattie. It's an interesting topic. I don't think most of the general public would have any idea what prison law entails, really, because unless you're involved in the prison system and the criminal justice system, then it's quite a niche area of law. Again, to me, I ended up practicing and specialising in prison law from my work with criminal law. I'd say the main difference, really, with prison law is that you're working generally with convicted prisoners. So apart from those on remand who might be in front of an independent adjudicator, you're generally working more with the prisons themselves and the parole board and the probation service. Predominantly my work involves the parole board, so it's risk assessments, finding out why people have offended, can they be managed in the community. Like I said, I do represent prisoners in terms of criminal charges before the independent adjudicator, but generally it's risk assessment rather than whether they're guilty or not. And I'll talk to you more about the parole board later on, perhaps, and we can expand on that.
Yes, no, that's very interesting. I think you're absolutely right. I think we all assume that, well, you don't really even think about it. Once somebody is convicted of a crime and they have a sentence and they go in to serve their sentence, you don't really think of prison law. I think I would think of it, or I've always thought of it, as the process that happens there rather than prison law. So it is really interesting, and I am really happy to be talking about it. Let's talk about, you know, prisoners' rights in terms of getting access to legal help. So does every prisoner have access to a prison law lawyer funded by, for example, the Legal Aid Authority if they're not able to afford to pay for legal fees privately?
No, unfortunately not. And that the public might be surprised by that, actually.
Well, my eyes just hit the ceiling when you said that, Carla. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. Gosh.
Yes, especially if you read certain newspapers. To be honest, Hattie, there's not actually that much legal aid out there for prisoners. So I would say there's a split, really, because prison law is actually, it falls within civil legal aid rather than criminal legal aid.
That's a bit strange in itself, isn't it?
Sort of. It's interesting. The parole work falls in the middle. It's a bit of a mix of criminal legal aid with civil legal aid, but then in terms of treatment, and if you go to judicially review decisions made by the prison service or the parole board or probation service, that actually is classed as civil legal aid because it falls within the judicial review remit. However, what it does lead to is there's a gap, if you like, for legal aid. So, over the recent years, legal aid for prisoners has reduced. The only legal aid available now is if your liberty is at stake. So, for example, a recalled prisoner applying to the parole board for re-release, or a life sentenced or indeterminate prisoner who are applying for the parole board for maybe their first release if they've been recalled, or adjudications, but it's only adjudications before the independent adjudicator who can add additional days. So the liberty has to be at stake. Many years ago, when I first started practicing, legal aid was available for all sorts of prisoner treatment, etc. However, that's gone out of scope now, which means initially, say for example, a prisoner writes to me, I've got a recategorisation review, I want to apply for my DCAT. There's no legal aid available. Now, that can make quite a considerable difference whether you're in a closed prison or an open prison. What it ends up leading to is that the prisoner would have to fund the case themselves, and it would only be if the prison, say for example, refused the DCAT and the reasons for doing so are just not legitimate. They are not quite correct. The law's not being followed. At that point, I would probably refer the case to a judicial review lawyer who can then apply for the funding if there's merit in the argument on that way.
Yes.
Problem is lots of prisoners can't afford to pay a solicitor.
Well, I
So,
mean, I am astonished that anything to do with a prisoner can fall into a civil matter. I just am astonished about that because they're there because they have been criminally charged. So the whole reason they're there is for criminal, because they've been criminally charged. It's all to do with criminal law. The prison law is to do, and I don't claim to know prison law at all, but the majority of it is to do with criminal, managing criminals and people that have been convicted. And then in comes this civil element, which is we're saying, oh, but to get help, it's to do, there's lots of it that falls into civil law, and therefore you don't automatically qualify for legal aid if you're a prisoner trying to get help. Wow.
So
I didn't expect that.
it's really limited on the scope because I no longer practice judicial review work, which is why you probably heard me say I would refer it on, simply because workload, you can't possibly cover everything. But yeah, it has caused a gap. So my work predominantly would be the legal aid for the recall prisoners, the independent adjudications, and the parole sentences. But again, even that, like I say, a lot of it's not about guilt. The parole board, for example, if they're considering a recall for a new offence, they'll be looking at the civil burden of proof rather than the criminal burden of proof. So yeah,
Wow,
it's quite
wow, wow.
interesting.
Well, yes, as I said, I totally didn't expect that one, but there you are. Let's talk about the types, different types of prison sentences. Now, I know there's probably lots and lots and lots, but let's just maybe the top three, Carla. Could you tell us what they are, for example?
Yeah, so the main ones I would say is probably what we call a determinate prison sentence, which a lot of people will know about. You get given 12 months, you serve 6 months, and the remainder of the 6 month is on license. So they tend to be your less serious crimes, could be shop theft. I work with them more on recalled sentences because generally they're not going to be going through the parole system. So it's only when a prisoner gets released, fails to comply with the conditions of the early release and comes back into prison that I tend to have contact with those sentences. The other type of sentences that I do work with quite regular are what we call the extended sentences. So they're more violent offenders and sexual offenders that have committed more serious crimes but are not eligible for a life sentence or indeterminate sentence. But what that generally means is that before they get released automatically, they do have the right to apply to the parole board to have an earlier release at the halfway point. And if they don't achieve that by the two-thirds point, that they will get automatically released, and then they'll be on license for an extended period. So I do see quite a lot of those when they're coming up to the halfway point where they can apply for parole, but that doesn't mean they're going to get it. It all goes down to risk assessment. And then the final sentence that I work with, or I'm going to lump them together, sentences, you've got the indeterminate sentences. So IPPs, they're in the media quite a lot. They're not a life sentence, but effectively they're very similar. So that means they'll get the IPP sentence, they'll get a minimum term, which could have been 2 years, many years ago, it could have been 5 years. They've actually been abolished now, but there's still many of these prisoners in the system. So once they've served their minimum term, they then have to sit before the parole board every 2 years, which may well mean that they don't get released after that minimum term. So we have many prisoners stuck in the system now with very short tariffs, but a 10 years plus over tariff. And they have to satisfy the parole board test, which we might talk about in a bit more depth later. But until then, they're sat in the system.
Yes.
And there's a lot of these prisoners.
Well, I mean, murder has carried a mandatory life sentence, hasn't it, in England and Wales, since capital punishment was suspended in 1965. And I was actually looking at life sentencing, and you know, you hear, and again, as a, you know, a member of the public, so to speak, life, and you think, does that actually mean lifetime? And then there's all the hearsay about, oh, people get life and they come out in 2 years or 5 years because they behave very well and it's all good. I mean, I found it very interesting that Britain's longest serving prisoner is a serial killer, Patrick McKay, and he has so far served 45 years after being jailed in 1975 for confessing to a string of brutal murders across London and Kent. In January 2021, and I think he started his bid in 2020, he made a bid for freedom, but I don't think, I'm not sure, and I don't think he'll be let out anytime soon. But the life order sentencing mechanism was first introduced in 1983, wasn't it, Carla? I think that was the date.
Yes, I think that sounds correct.
And then, according to Wikipedia, as of 2017, there are believed to be 75 prisoners currently serving a whole life sentence in England and Wales. I found that number quite small when I looked at the numbers of, well, there's over 78,000 prisoners in England and Wales at the moment, and there's 75, and that, I mean, I know that was as of 2017, prisoners serving life sentence, but what does a life sentence mean? Does it mean for the whole of someone's life, or do people get life sentences and then get out for good behaviour after 5 or 10 years, or, you know, and not serve life, basically?
Yes, it's a very interesting topic. And again, there's so much poor communication from the media what a life sentence means. So effectively, a life sentence means that prisoner may secure early release. So they will be given a tariff in court. If it's murder, it's going to be quite a lengthy tariff. But again, I don't want to go into it too much detail, but the courts have minimum terms set out in statute, the sentencing guidelines. So it's a case by case basis. But for example, if a prisoner receives a life sentence, has a minimum term of 10 years, the 10 years simply means that's the first time they can apply to the parole board for release. So up until that 10-year period, they can't be released.
Right. So let me just clarify that in my own head. So if you get a life sentence, it's for your life. It's for the period and duration of your life. May you, you know, if you live 10 years or 30 years or 50 years. And the years, the actual amount of years attached to it, is the first time you can apply to say, I've been really good, I've learnt my lesson, for example, will you release me? In a nutshell, yes.
That's exactly what it means. That doesn't mean they're going to get released. They have to satisfy the parole board of a particular test, which basically, again, comes down to risk assessment, whether they can be managed in the community. I know plenty of prisoners who may have a low minimum term tariff, but they end up serving 20 years, could be 30 years, because they can never satisfy that test. So I think in terms of the miscommunication that sometimes happen with the public, the media will lead them to believe, well, he's been convicted of murder and he's got a 10-year sentence.
That is exactly what we see. And I said, and I have questioned it. You know, I've questioned it. How is that life? That's just not life. And then what we all go on to start chuntering about is that, oh, well, you know what? In other countries, life means life, you know, yes. And we're far, 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 really relaxed here in the UK. But yes. It's really interesting to hear that the amount of years attached to a life sentence is not what the prisoner will serve and get out in. It's just when they can apply, the first time that they can consider parole. Very interesting. Let's have a look at COVID, because I don't think any conversation can happen without mentioning COVID. As much as people might be absolutely sick to death with the word COVID, let's look at that. How have prisoners been affected by COVID? What have you seen?
Yes, it's, I mean, COVID has affected us all, and I think it would be very easy for the public to forget and also feel that, well, they're prisoners, what rights should they have, what do they expect? And prisons can be portrayed in this country as being a bit of a holiday camp, but let me tell you now, they're not. COVID has really affected prisoners, and I would say the most significant and worrying aspect of it, well, there's two points that do concern me. So the first one is prisoners being locked in a cell for 23 hours a day, sometimes 23 and a half hours a day. Some of those prisoners are alone in their cells, and it's effectively segregation, and that has been pretty much for most of the time we've been in these.
Can I ask you, Carla, sorry, can I ask you, are prisoners being locked up for 23 or 23 and a half hours a day because of COVID?
Yes.
So would they have been allowed out of their cells a lot more had COVID not been in place?
Yes.
Right. And what would be the, I'm going to ask you, do we know what the average time, hours a day prisoners are? You know, we're taking an average here, so I know it's can be case by case, or each prison may have its own rules, but on average, how long would a prisoner be let out normally in any event if there was no COVID?
Generally, they're out, again, it's a case by case basis, but if a prisoner's working or in education or going on to courses, they get out in the morning, they get out in the afternoon. Certain jobs afford for extra privileges in terms of being out of their cells. There's absolutely, they shouldn't be locked up unless they're on segregation for punishment or their own mental health or protection. 23 and a half hours a day is not what they should be being locked up. Now, I'm sure there'll be prisoners out there that will tell me, well, even before COVID, I was spending that long in prison because maybe at weekends there wasn't enough prison staff, but that shouldn't have been happening really. Since COVID, because especially when we've been in lockdown, because like ourselves, we weren't allowed to really leave our homes only for certain reasons. Prisoners were the same. The problem is their homes were their cells.
Yes.
And what is worrying from my aspect is that the impact, the long-term impact on a prisoner's mental health. I remember a few years ago, I attended a course and the statistics were prisoners being put on segregation, or if you like, isolation. After 14 days, the damage done to their mental health is actually irreversible. That's what I was told on a course.
Wow.
So if you've got all these prisoners throughout this period, on and off being isolated alone in their cells for 23 and a half hours a day, my concern is long-term, what damage has been done to their mental health? I would say that's the biggest aspect. The other aspect that I'm coming across is that we are still struggling to have access to legally advised prisons. So some of the prisons putting the video links, we've been able to have carry on preparing their cases for parole, which has kept going throughout the COVID. They've adapted really well. We have telephone hearings, we have video link hearings. Some of the prisons, we have access to the prisoners, so we've been able to go in on video links or telephone conferences. Some prisons still have not been able to facilitate that. And whilst there's some that still say you can go in, but obviously it's very limited now when you can go in because of all their restrictions on contact across wings. adding the difficulty there, again, obviously we've got to think of the prisoners, we've got to think of the staff.
No, absolutely. So getting... Absolutely. So you getting access to prisoners to be able to continue the work that you would be doing for them, for their cases to progress in relation to parole in the ways that they've had to. I mean, according to The Guardian, in February 2021, 1 in 8 prisoners in England and Wales have had COVID. That's a lot.
Yes, that is a lot.
But I don't want to run out of time and not discuss this, because this is a biggie. So I'm going to ask you the next question, if I may.
Okay.
That for me is, what is the test for the parole board to consider when deciding whether to grant a prisoner release? I mean, and parole is the officially termed for early release. But, you know, again, I talk as a member of the public who hears that, well, it's good behaviour. And that's the only thing I probably know about. And it's that the prisoner has behaved well. And I think, well, you know what, as a layperson, I'll say that it's probably, yes, I can imagine it's challenging to behave well if you're put under pressure and in different circumstances, which are very, I could imagine, very, very difficult and challenging in prison. But then you can argue that, well, you know, it's probably not that difficult to just behave really, 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 really well in order to get out. So you tell us, what are the biggest tests that a parole board looks for? Carla.
Okay, so the test that the parole board have to apply is the prisoner's risk of serious harm, and it's serious harm as opposed to just harm.
To themselves or to the public, we're talking about, or both?
Is it to the public?
Right.
Is the risk of serious harm to the public manageable in the community? And obviously that's open to interpretation, and you think, well, what is that? It's not just about good behaviour, otherwise the test would be, has the prisoner behaved well? That's not the test. And this is how prisoners end up delayed in the system. So the recalled ones, they've always got sentence expiry date, so they will get out eventually, even if they never meet that test. The difficulty we have is with the IPPs and the lifers, because they don't have an end date. It's not just about good behaviour. Like you say, some prisoners are great. They behave perfect all the way through.
But Carla, I'm just going to stop you there, because I need to have this conversation for my own sanity. How do you measure if someone's been really well behaved in prison and they've been there, for argument's sake, 5 years? How on earth do you measure whether they will be a danger to the public out in the outside if you've only been able to evaluate them in a cell and in a prison? How does that even happen?
So there's lots of different ways. Generally with longer sentence prisoners, they get tested in open conditions. So they're semi in the public, they get overnight release. So they get a bit of time, and they can be judged on that, how they perform. And the other way is the probation service. And also a lot of my prisoners that I work with, the long-termers, I work very closely with psychologists. So lots of psychological risk assessments to assess. We can't predict people's behaviour in the future. Prisoners can go all the way through. They can have all the psychologist recommendations, probation support. And they get out, and some of them offend again. Some of them get recalled, not for re-offending, but they might breach their licence conditions. It's all to do with risk assessments. And yes, that can be very vague. It's not a strict liability offence we're dealing with, where it's black and white, you've done this, therefore you're guilty. A lot of it is open to interpretation. So you could easily sit on a panel. One parole panel would direct release because they interpret the evidence that this person is safe enough. And another panel might be more risk averse, and their interpretation might be, oh, well, we feel that something else needs to be done before this prisoner is going to be ready. So, it's interesting, but it is open to interpretation.
So there's lots that has to go on, really, isn't there? It's not just a case where, for example, you may assist a prisoner in making an application for parole. And as you say, in my sort of lay head, it comes out as, well, they're great, the character's great, and 5 years, a long time, or however many years, and they should definitely be let out into the public again. And you know, particularly if that's all they're known, that, you know, psychological assessments, and you have lots lots of resources which have to come together and all tick the right boxes,
yes,
for that prisoner, yeah, to be able to. Because you made an interesting comment earlier when you said that even though people that have been served long sentences and they're given their sort of the first opportunity of when they can ask for parole, that the majority don't get parole. And you know what, I'd love to do a part two to this podcast because I have got a million questions for you that we're just not going to get to fit in for today.
But
I'd love our team to start looking into statistics on, you know, how many people versus get parole versus those that apply and how many reoffend. I think they're really interesting statistics to look at and really it'd be really interesting to talk about those. So it's not just about good behaviour. There is a lot of work that has to come together. I mean, is there, if you could give me an average of how long from the point of application or preparing even to make an application, does it take for somebody to actually get to the stage where a parole board makes a decision either way? Is there sort of a generic time scale? And, you know, and I said, obviously case by case, but as a general guide, what is that time frame like, Carla?
I would say generally it's about a period of 12 months, which runs alongside when they can start to apply for legal aid to start working with a prison lawyer. However, some of my cases working on them for 2 to 3 years. That may well be because when they actually make their first application and get to the hearing, something in the case isn't ready. Because things do not run smoothly in our system, and people don't necessarily comply with dates they're being given. And then often we might get to the first hearing and that might then turn into a directions hearing. And then to get your next parole hearing, it's several months down the line. And you might start your hearing and end up going part heard because the parole board needs something completing. And again, your next hearing might take place in 6 months. So it's really easy to see how these cases can end up lasting for years.
Well, I hear you. And, you know, again, I say it, it's such an interesting area of law. And there's so much that we can talk about. And I've already started to make notes of the other bits that I do want to talk about with you in a part two. So I'm going to hold you to that, Carla, to a part two. And that's all we've got time for today.
Oh, thank you, Hattie. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much for joining me today. And I hope that, you know, what we've had to discuss will give some good insights into this area of law that, you know, quite frankly, a few years ago, didn't even know it existed. So it's good to know that it does. What I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.